But anyway, so, I mean, Kant, for example, on the ethics front, I think he was genuinely down with the terror. The idea that, you know, oh, good God, we have to have some, you know, if we're going to avoid relativism, if we're going to avoid anything goes in ethics, if we're going to be able to say this is right and this is wrong, there has to be at least a belief in an absolute lawgiver and an absolute set of laws. So if, for example, the old chestnut, if somebody kind of comes up to me and says, you know, do you know where Danny O'Donnell lives? Because that guy did me wrong back in the day. And, you know, I'm gonna teach him a lesson. Kant would say that I shouldn't lie. I'm not sure whether, I suspect he doesn't necessarily say I ought to tell him where you live. But I can't say, oh yeah, Danny's dead already, or, you know, Danny moved to Australia. Sorry, Nessa. I can't lie. And that's largely because Kant is saying, well, you know, as soon as you start to try and predict your actions, you are essentially trying to operate on the throne that God has recently vacated. So it's kind of, if you're sitting in the divine throne, and you're kind of looking down in that kind of Jason and the Argonauts, we've mentioned, so Jason and the Argonauts kind of view, where kind of the gods are in heaven playing kind of chess with humanity and saying, okay, now we're going to do this, now we're going to do that. Now I can just pick this guy up and then put him somewhere else. And they have complete control over humanity. If you've got that position, you can make judgments. You can say, I know if you do that, that's going to happen because I'm God. But we don't know that, do we?
But how does he reach? So to get to this point, it's a kind of two things happening. It's like we must have these fixed rules, but we're also humans and we've got this capacity. So this categorical imperative, isn't it?
That's right. Coming up with a
rule, but that rule is born through our reason. It's like a bit of practical as well as.
Yes.
Theory.
Yes. And it's almost, I mean, it's in a way, I mean, if I'm arguing from Kant's point of view here, in a way, it is a belief. You know, Kant says it is practical reason. It's not pure reason. So practical reason is something that, in a sense, you have to assume, because otherwise the world makes no sense. So it's that kind of thing. And I think although the critique of pure reason is the volume that, you know, he's known more for, because it's all about kind of knowledge and epistemology, what we can, can't know, and so on. And, you know, a lot of philosophy after that draws on it, including, you know, the Vienna Circle and Wittgenstein and so on. The critique of practical reason is actually, I think, is a cleverer piece. But because it's more knife-edgy, it's because you're kind of, you know, it's because it's more tacit. It's saying, you know, there are things that we have to assume. If we look around the world, there are things perhaps we can't understand. There are gaps there, but there are certain things we have to assume operate in those gaps. For example, we have to assume a lawgiver. If we don't assume a lawgiver, then we can't assume absolute laws. And if we can't assume absolute laws, then everything is up for grabs. So, and I think, you know, in terms of, as you said earlier on, about the kind of chaos of human existence, so many voices, so many points of view, so many factors to consider. I mean, I'm sure we've had this conversation before. I'm sure you feel the same. You just often just feel, I am not in possession of enough information, of enough quality, factual information to make a realistic judgment on this matter. I just feel that I'm confused. You know, nobody's telling me enough, and I don't know who to trust anymore. And if I'm just told, oh, well, you know, you have to make a decision, and it has to be based on all the factors, and it has to be based on all the kind of issues, and you have to review all those, I would never make a judgment.
Yes.
And I think this is where Kant is coming from. He's saying, you know, we would end up being ethically paralysed.
his great thing is from the critique of pure reason, the synthetic a priori. That's the idea that, you know, there's a little bit of like our practical human side in that equation. There's humanness in there, and I think that's like as I understand it, that's where he's coming from with these producing these. Okay, we're going to have a universal law, but it's going to be based on our human understanding. Our not God out there. It's what's in our heads.
Mm.
The problem I have with it, and that's is that I find it hard to believe that you can make a leap from that to a universal law. I think like it's always going to be up for grabs. There's always going to be something in there, you know, that's going to make it different every time, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't like you to let the murderer in to find me because you can't lie. It's just you know, that's a problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, we do this all the time. I mean, Kant kind of says this about, and Hume as well in a way, and post-critical people like Michael Polanyi, for example, all have this view that even the sciences all reduce down to conviction and acts of faith. Ultimately, you get to a point where you believe something to be the case. So, I mean, crudely, Polanyi, for example, says, and Hume, for that matter, says that, you know, our belief in science, it's custom and habit. It's stuff we believe. We start out by saying, and it's, we start out by saying, this is not an empirical statement because you can't observe it. We start out by saying, the universe makes sense. The universe makes sense. It's an ordered machine, which means that if we study it, as impassionately as we can, we should understand how that machine works. It's like a watch. We can take the watch apart. We can see how all the cogs fit together and how they drive the hands. Unless, of course, it's an iWatch, in which case there are no cogs. But I mean, you see what I mean? You know, so you take it all apart. You can see how the things all work together, and we understand it. And that's the kind of the basis of science. But people like Polanyi and Hume saying, "Well, that isn't that's a belief. We've got no
consumption.
Yeah, it's an assumption. We've got no way of demonstrating that foundational belief. I mean, the universe might make entirely different sense elsewhere in the universe. I mean, even Einstein. And I'm not an expert. I'm not a scientist. But I mean, as I understand it, even Einstein made the point that at different points in the universe, different speeds in the universe, you know, the so-called absolute laws of the universe." Are in flux. And also we don't know that what might be a law today. There is no empirical proof that what apparently is a law today will be a law tomorrow. And Hume makes that absolutely clear. You know, all we can say is that things have run this way so far. But we can't say they always will because you don't have access to that. So here's Kant, I think, quite rightly saying, well, you know, if we can't be sure, then we just have to establish for everything, a set of beliefs which are the foundational beliefs. So you want to believe that the universe makes sense, that's fine. You believe the universe makes sense and you conduct science on that basis, and it seems to work so far. Similarly with ethics, if you want to be ethical, if you want to say that there is a right and a wrong in any situation, then you have to establish a foundational belief, a practical belief about the nature of the universe, and the nature of the universe is one that makes moral sense. There is
that's where my boy Jezza Bentham comes in.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah. Hit me with some Jez, man.
He's coming into it saying, "What? Stop all this nonsense. There's no God.
Yeah.
This is what we're talking about is stuff that you can't really grab hold of." So he talks about these what he called fictional entities. Words. This is good. It's like there is a line here to Wittgenstein in terms of looking at language, which is great. I never knew this until today as I was studying it. fictional entities: right, duty, property, obligations. So you see, he took these words and he translated them down to what fundamentally are they pointing to? And his big thing is of course the avoidance of pain and the promotion of the good and the pleasure. So pain or pleasure, we know that if I stick you with a fork, that's gonna hurt. Yeah? If you're gonna drink your beer, that's pleasure. Basic human understanding. We don't need to think about, is it right to do this? it's right to do that if it gives you the most pleasure, it gives the maximum amount of pleasure. That makes sense. So in terms of understanding the universe, working your inside out, work from the subject. What gives us what is the most good? Good for us, good for everybody.
Mm.
And how can we stop things that cause pain? I think that's a kind of a good way to start looking at a moral system.
You think?
Wouldn't you agree?
I don't know. I mean, I can see what you mean. And I can see, by the way, anybody who's not familiar with Jeremy Bentham, just a little thing here. You can look back on our podcast. His body is kind of stuffed and mounted in University College London, in a glass case, and apparently can rival colleges. You know, I think King's College would routinely try and break in and steal the body, but he does look genuinely mummified. But he is he's dressed in the gear. You know, he's dressed in his pantaloons. And
but he's such an atheist that he wanted to kind of present a case that he doesn't care about, the kind of physical self.
Yeah.
And so he gave orders to be stuffed, and he's in a glass, as you say, in like a glass case, and he's actually wheeled out on special occasions. if you do Google it, there's a horrible picture of his head.
Oh God, yeah, which
kind of went bad.
Yeah, my daughter, who's an archaeologist, has this great term that she uses for this sort of thing, and she says his head has become baconated.
Yes, definitely baconated.
So I think baconated. So he's got, so I think he has a. I think the glass case is like a false wax head there. To I don't think the real head is in a box somewhere.
Yeah,
there's a lot of Futurama. So like in a jar, and it's just like talking about the hedonic calculus in a jar somewhere in University College. Oh, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
So you mentioned the hedonic calculus. So his kind of nuts and bolts way of approaching morality and ethics was just working out what causes the most good and the least bad, if we think about a moral law.
Mm.
I think so. It seems very, very simplistic. And it is.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of problems with it, I think. But at first you think, oh, that kind of makes sense, because that's kind of like what we do. As
yes.
Like, as we grow up, with children, you work out something hurts, not going to do that again.
Mm.
Oh, that food is good, I'll have more of that. That seems like the most basic way to approach being in the world.
Yeah. I can see the practicality of that. And it fits with what we've been saying about the Enlightenment suddenly throwing up its hands in horror and thinking, oh dear Lord, how are we, well, not even oh dear Lord, obviously, how do we establish, what is right and wrong? We still want to say, that you don't want to go kind of full on kind of anarchy. We still want to be able to say that some things are right, some things are wrong. But how do we actually justify this? Kant takes the route, there has to be a starting point for anything, we might just as well assume a kind of an absolute lawgiver on the basis that we can never make a judgment based on a godlike view of all the factors. So what we have to do is we just have to lay down absolute ethical claims: no killing, no stealing. Basically, nothing antisocial, nothing that does harm to another person. Under no circumstances. You shouldn't lie. You shouldn't kill. You shouldn't cheat. You shouldn't steal. Or the essential kind of the essential Ten Commandments. I mean, not so much with the oxen. I mean, I'm not sure oxen are all that relevant now in an ethical thing. Don't covet your neighbour's ox or something. So, you've got, and I can get behind that. Sometimes you just, sometimes I'll think to myself, I don't know why I believe this to be the case. I'm sitting there and I'm looking at kind of, for example, the Black Lives Matter issues, or kind of, sexual and gender kind of issues and kind of political issues. I'm in my head, I am assuming a standard that, everybody should be treated equally. Nobody should be harmed. Nobody should be hurt. Nobody should be given, you know, an unequal status. But if somebody came to me and just said, well, why?
Yeah.
Outside of, I mean, this is the problem. Outside of a religious tradition, which said, you know, you shouldn't kill because God gave human life, and only God has the right to take it away. And, you know, God has a plan for this individual human being. So who are you to subvert that plan? Outside of that, it's very difficult. You know, it's like, you know, when you're doing stuff, you know, when you're kids and you were doing and you were doing bad stuff, it was kind of the ultimate arbiter was your parents.
Yeah.
So, you know, my sister would constantly be running to like my mum or whatever and saying, you know, oh, you know, he's done it again. Tell him not to do it. He's not supposed to do it. And, yeah. You know, she was the ultimate arbiter. My mother said, you know, you shouldn't do that. I told you not to do that. And that was the end of story. I mean, I didn't have to get into a discussion about it. It was just kind of, well, mum says it's not right. And I follow that. And maybe Cantor's saying that's what we need. We need a set of absolutes. Mm. Don't try and kind of, you know, try and make sense of it. Or don't try and, you know, try and predict all the stages in the future. You know, as you said, I could lie. I could lie to the murderer coming to look for you, Danny. I could say, Danny's no longer here. Danny emigrated to Australia. And you might survive, but this guy might hop on a flight to Australia. He may kind of, you know, find his way to kind of Vanessa's place. You know, he could give her a hard time, you know, and, you know, steal her dog and, you know, and drink all her wine and give her a hard time. And then just continue through the population of Australia, just doing awful things, just because I lied, just to save you. So, you know, maybe I should have lied. Maybe I shouldn't have lied. Maybe I should have said, yeah, Danny lives there. And, you know, if he goes to find you, maybe you take him out. Maybe he has a change of mind on the way. You can't ever know, can you?
Yeah, but it seems to me, like, I think Jeremy Bentham would come back and look at the kind of the fundamental motive behind that. Mm. Like the idea that there has to be an arbiter. There has to be a all-powerful giver of laws. He say, well, the motivation behind that is fear, and fear. Mm. It would go down again. Pain.
Fear is the mind killer.
Fear is definitely the mind killer.
Geeks amongst us, follow that one up. But then isn't Bentham the same? I mean, Bentham is saying, you know, utilitarianism, the hedonic calculus. You know, it's again the pleasure pain. We just fear the pain. We fear kind of the bad stuff. So really, what we're encouraging people to do, it's almost a form of behaviorism. It's kind of if you behave in this way, you'll get the rewards, you'll feel happier. And if you behave in that way, you'll feel more miserable and you'll lose out on the rewards.
That's basically what he says.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of, it seems like a fairly shabby way to conduct ethics. It's kind of, isn't it a little bit selfish? Isn't it kind of,
I think it's an attack. I think it's a bit of an attack on the idea that there is any kind of natural, as you said, like natural rights and laws. Mm. Around that time, we're like, oh, well, you know, what's the American saying? The right to liberty.
Yeah.
You know, natural rights. And he said, well, he says nonsense on stilts.
Stilts, yeah.
And he's saying this is just a desire to have something.
Yeah.
He said, hunger is not bread.
Mm.
So we have to strip
it. Not territory.
We have to strip it back. The only thing we can believe in is, you know, the fact that the kind of self-interestedness. But that, I suppose that also can be, self-interestedness can mean you want good for everybody, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. I mean, I do find that interesting because, I mean, the whole idea of I mean, is the antipathy towards natural rights in Bentham. Was also in a way motivated by fear, because, and again, it's a kind of a typical Enlightenment fear, the fear of the anarchic, the fear of everything, you know, the centre not holding, the fear of everything kind of collapsing into anarchy, where each person interprets natural rights in their own way, either a religious way or an ideological way or whatever, and natural rights. A natural law becomes a get out, kind of a meta narrative beyond kind of legality. So it's kind of a get out. So it's kind of saying, oh, well,
I
you
know my rights. I
yeah,
my rights.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, well, you know, the law, mates, you know, the law that we've established as part of our society, that this should, we should do this and we shouldn't do that. You know, that was just established by society. You know, I answer to a higher power. I answer to a higher law. And it's, and he says that's the fear, that, you know, and if you establish a higher law beyond the laws of society, then it's a cop-out of acting as part of society and acting legal. So he says, so law is all you have. I mean, and he equates, in a sense, he kind of equates morality with law. We establish the laws for our community and we live according to those laws, because otherwise, as soon as you have some kind of meta-law established on the basis of, you know, human rights, then anything goes, because anybody could argue, you know, I'm appealing to the heart. To, I mean, it's like we've referred to this before, but I quite like this as an image. There's a great image in 2000 AD with Judge Dredd, and you've got and it's like, I think it's like a splash panel, and you've got somebody interviewing Judge Dredd. We have been here before, and you've got the Statue of Liberty. There, and it's the Statue of Liberty, and then behind it, you've got much bigger. I mean, towering above it, you've got the Statue of Justice, and Judge Dredd's being interviewed, and he says, "Well, you know," and the interviewer saying, "So, you know, how come the Statue of Justice is so much taller than the Statue of Liberty?" And, you know, and Judge Dredd says, "Well, okay, yeah, you know, I appreciate liberty." I mean, he's not, cause he's fascist. He's, "I appreciate liberty, and, you know, obviously, you know, we are fighting as judges for liberty, but people have to realise that liberty stands in the shadow of justice, of law, and because that is the only way you can protect liberty." Is by establishing a system of laws, a system of justice, which protects that, and that stands above it. And, so, and the population, so they prefer that. They want to know that there is a law to back up their ethic, what they consider to be right and wrong.
Cue photographs of like decked out police outside the front of, you know. Justice.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. We're getting. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's. I suppose that's the problem with a kind of a Bentham-esque utilitarianism, that you can say, okay, we are going to establish these laws based on hedonic calculus, and we are going to enforce a system of ethics and a system of law based on the greatest happiness for the greatest number. It always means that the minority gets screwed.